what are you doing for the rest of your life? We could watch the stars at night twinkling high above. 'Cause I promise you, for the rest of your life, I will be there by your side. I will be.
Gentlemen, welcome to the French Connections Wednesday edition. Today's date is February 28th, 2007. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here for another installment of the French Connection. It's a great day to be telling the truth, ladies and gentlemen. We've got a guest today, a friend of mine. I've been working with this gentleman for going on years now. We've actually met personally. He's been to my home. He knows where I live. Knows that I'm not just a make-believe person, been stopped in and had some dinner, and he's been writing stories about 9/11 and this criminal conspiracy and the people who are behind it for some years now, and for a long time he was associated with an organization that he has come to believe is not on the up and up, and we're going to discuss that today, that being American Free Press, as well as, he's in a situation now where it seems though as though Homeland Security, it might be targeting him for a legal case that is erupting here as a result of him being attacked on his own property in not that long ago. I guess it was about 2.5-3 months ago. Many of you are aware of that as well. His name is Christopher Bolin. He's a freelance journalist and a friend of ours here at the French Connection. I'd like to welcome him back to the show. Christopher, are you with me?
Hello, yes. Can you hear me?
Sure can, Chris. It sounds real good, too. In fact, one of the things I want to start out with is your case, because, you know, this is something, this is an ongoing thing, and there's been some new information that you were able to find regarding the police call of that day. And if you want to give people a little thumbnail sketch of how they came to come to your house in the first place and why you felt it was necessary to call, because we've talked about it in the past, but if there's new listeners out there, they may want to understand what happened that day and why you called the police, on the police, actually.
Sure. Well, I came back to the United States from Europe last March of 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And I visited, some important people involved in 9/11 research, like Professor Jones in Utah, Professor Cahill at University of California, Davis, Eric Hubschmid in California. And I was putting together their research because their research corroborates each other. They corroborate each other, but these men don't usually talk to each other.
Yeah.
And Professor Jones, his research on the molten metal found at the World Trade Center is corroborated by the research of Thomas Cahill, who studied the plumes of smoke coming from the World Trade Center for 3 months after the event.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric Hubschmid has done a lot of research about the disinformation and the co-opting by people who are not interested in the truth of the 9/11 movement,
yeah,
so to speak. And as all these people know, especially Eric knows, and other people that I visited, Ellen Mariani, for example, they knew that I was very reluctant to go back to my home in Chicago, because the reason we had left Chicago was because we learned that we were being surveilled by FBI informants. And I just assume this is because of my research into 9/11 and my writing a weekly article or a weekly two articles for American Free Press, which is a newspaper I used to work for. Well, we came back to Chicago in July of last year,
mm-hmm.
and we quickly took a road trip to North Dakota for a family reunion, because I just didn't feel comfortable there, seeing that there was a lot of police activity around my house, which was unusual.
And I want to remind everybody, you lived in a very quiet bedroom community, a very, very limited crime in your neighborhood, almost none, in fact, a small place. Your family actually was one of the founding families of the community, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it's a bedroom community, Hoffman Estates, it's northwest of Chicago. My family moved in there in 57. I grew up there, very quiet bedroom community. no crime to speak of. The only event that comes along because you've heart attack or something like that. And yet I noticed when we came back in July, I was doing some work on the roof. I noticed that a police cruiser would go by my house almost every hour. And I thought, and the only people who really knew that I was home were my employers, the people at American Free Press. The editor, Chris Petrick, had always asked me when we spoke, where are you? He always wanted to know where I am. And people who always want to know where I am, I distrust, because why do they need to know where I am? Yeah. In any case, in August 14th, I was on the bike. We'd only been home for about 10 days from this trip out west. And I noticed a car going by with three heavily armed men wearing body armor about a half a block from my house.
They looked like SWAT members, yeah?
Yeah, they looked like, SWAT team without the helmets. They were civilian, wearing civilian clothes. They were driving a dark car. And they were, as on my bike I could see, they were heavily armed. They were armed men, and they were wearing body armor. And there were three of them. And this was most unusual. I told my wife about it, and I thought about it. Next day, I came out of my house about 6 o'clock at night, 6:20 or so. I stepped out on my porch, and lo and behold, the very same car is going very slowly in front of my house with these three guys in it, and the windows are down, they're leaning out the window, and they're going past a group of kids in my front yard. There are maybe a half a dozen kids under the maple tree. And then I couldn't believe it. And I told my wife again, when I saw this car, I just said, hello, FBI, and about, like that. I was just flabbergasted that this car was again in my neighborhood. And the person in the passenger seat just raised his hand and, like, waved, like, hello. And they were going, it's a 20-mile street, but this car was going about 15 miles an hour, 10 miles an hour in front of my house, very slowly.
No.
And I thought, this is crazy. I told my wife, and then she said, well, you should ask them who they are. What do they want? Well, I got on the bicycle, and I was going to the store. It was the end of my working day, and I had to get some things at the store. And by the time I got to the store, I was really alarmed. I mean, my thoughts had gotten, my wheels had gotten spinning, and I said, I called 911 from the store. I called the 911 number.
Yeah.
And the car with a suspicious vehicle with three armed men is prowling around my house for now. So I'm very concerned. I think they might be feds. That was just my hunch.
Yeah.
Did you say that
in the call?
I beg your pardon?
Did you say to the police department you think it's federal agents?
Yeah, I told them that because that was what I, when I had said hello FBI and they had waved back, I thought that was an acknowledgement that that's who they were. I didn't think they were local police because I'd never seen local police like that. And you have to remember that I work in Washington, D.C. My office was in Washington, D.C. for 5-6 years, and this is the kind of thing you see around the White House, for example. These kinds of men who don't have any uniform, whose only identifying mark is perhaps a lapel pin that they wear, but the lapel pin is only understood if you happen to be a conoscente, if you know what that pin means. Around Lafayette Park, around the White House, there are hordes of people like this, particularly when there's a protest. And these people will come out of nowhere, and they're all wearing, like, gray suits and body armor in their arms, but you don't know who they are. And the purpose of a uniform, for a policeman to have a uniform, is so that the public can see, that's a uniformed policeman. He's a guy I can trust. He's a symbol of law and order. Well, to make a long story short, they said, I said, okay, they'll send an officer to my house in about 20 minutes. I got in the house. I picked up my brother's cell phone. I tried to call the local police, Hoffman State's police, on their number, and I had to look it up. And I called them up. I wanted to know is somebody coming? And then I looked out the front window, and this very car was now in front of my house, and three men were speaking to my wife and my 8-year-old daughter on my driveway. And my adrenaline shot up. I was alarmed. Now I don't know who these people are. I came outside. I joined my wife. I asked them who they were and what they wanted and what they were doing going around my house with all this, equipment. And they didn't answer any of those questions. They didn't say that they were responding to an 11 call. They didn't say that they didn't identify themselves as being Hoffman State's police. and began to explain what their business was going around with all this equipment around my house for 2 days in a row. So I said, the conversation was very short, and I could see they weren't going to answer my questions. I said, okay, I have to get my brother. And I have an older brother in the house who lives there all the time. So I turned around. I went towards my house. I went about 3 steps, and I was tackled from behind, knocked to the ground, handcuffed, and tasered. And I was tasered when I was being held to the ground with one 200-pound man kneeling on the side of my head with his full body weight, and the other one kneeling on my right elbow, which my right arm was pinned under my body. This resulted in a fracture of my right elbow. And the pressure on my head, my wife said, made my face turn purple, and my eyes were bulging out, and she said I had a hard time breathing. So they stuck this device against my lower back, and they shocked the hell out of me with this taser thing, which I didn't really know what it was, but it was tremendously offensive, and I was really shocked and insulted. Well, that was it. They took me away, and they charged me with resisting arrest and aggravated assault.
But now again, I've asked this question of you before, Christopher. A resisting arrest is not a charge. You have to being arrested for something in the first place to be charged with resisting. In other words, there has to be an arrest reason before they can get you for resisting arrest. Am I wrong in that?
No, you're right. There has to be an actual arrest, and you know, I've had a very incompetent lawyer up until now, and he's that person who says, you know, you have no right to resist an illegal arrest. And I tell him, well, Mr. Smeaton, his name is Jack Smeaton, I say, Mr. Smeaton, there was no arrest prior to the assault, and there was no resistance during the assault, so at what point did I resist anything? And since I was on my property, I had called 911, and these men had not identified themselves. I thought I had every right to go and get my brother in the house. My brother studied law. He's older. He's the permanent resident at that address. I thought he could come out and help us resolve this matter. But now I see that the police weren't there to resolve the matter at all. Now, here's the important thing, is that I filed an FOIA request with the police to, you know, get some idea of transmission. And I got this log, the transmission log. And the transmission log shows that there were 8 police officers in 5 vehicles that had been dispatched to my house before anybody even arrived on the scene. Now, this is a non-emergency 911 call, and they dispatched 5 cars with 8 officers, including a special tactical unit, to respond to a 911 non-emergency call. Isn't that a bit wasteful of resources? And then what becomes very interesting is this police transmission log indicates that actually a uniformed officer had been dispatched to my house, but that after he had been dispatched to my house, this tactical team, about a minute later, decided to assist. And yet, what's most interesting is that the first officer on the scene was an officer named Crucial, Joseph Crucial, who was actually a uniformed officer. And yet he apparently reported being on the scene, but held himself back either around the corner or a few houses down the street and waited for another minute or half a minute for this tactical squad to arrive to engage me. Now, this doesn't make any sense at all. When Europeans hear this, they can't believe it. They say, you know, first of all, it's very unprofessional and threatening to send a tactical squad with 3 armed men to respond to a 9/11 call in which they are the subject of concern. They were the object of my fear. They were the object of my concern. And it wasn't like they came to mollify or alleviate my concern. One officer didn't maybe come out and come into the house and say, Mr. Bolin, don't worry, we're just a tactical squad. We're doing some surveillance. We're doing some whatever. They told my brother they were doing gang suppression. However, my neighborhood has no gangs. This is the, you know, late summer. There are no gangs in my neighborhood, never have been. They told me later, a month later, they said they were doing cross-training. And yet the whole police record is falling apart. It doesn't make any sense. It appears to indicate, the evidence in the police log indicates that there was a conspiracy by several police officers and perhaps the chief to intimidate and threaten me with this tactical squad although a uniformed officer was on the scene. Now, that's very serious because that's a federal conspiracy to violate my civil rights, which is a very severe crime.
Now, I've got a question for you. It is also required by law for these people to keep their dispatch tapes. There are tapes of your call coming into the police department that are required by law to be held, and there are also dispatch tapes of the orders going out to the cars that were called in to be sent to your home. And are you able, have you been able to subpoena those tapes so that you can actually hear the dispatcher's transmissions and the conversations in the cars?
Yes, that's what we're trying to do. And the 9/11 dispatch center in Northwest Chicago just told us the other day that they are that this is the tape that's been subpoenaed. But somehow the subpoena that my attorney gave to this dispatch center, as finally on January 31st, they had misplaced or lost or he hadn't filed it correctly. And now they tell us we faxed it again yesterday, and they said yes, these transmissions should be on that tape. But, I mean, that's very important because these transmissions will indicate what the officers are saying to each other.
That's right.
And, yeah.
And it'll also give you an idea of what kind of orders were being given out by the dispatch as well.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's definitely another brick in the wall of this story, Chris, because, you know, once you get the motivation coming from the dispatcher, you're going to know what the administration at your police department was telling their officers to do. And that will give you an idea whether the higher ups were actually knowledgeable or, had some sort of, it'll indicate a conspiracy, I think.
Right. Well, 2 days after this happened, on August 17th, we went to the police department and we recorded a conversation we had, an interview we had with the village manager and the chief of police, Clint Hertigan. And he told us that he had made the decision. He had made the decision to send this tactical unit to my house. And what happens is that when people look at that log, it's that police log, they can look at it on the IamTheWitness.com website. I put it up there yesterday. You can see that when all was said and done, it was something like 8 police vehicles were dispatched to my house, and all of them except one had been dispatched before anybody had arrived on the scene. Now, that is incredible. Why would they dispatch 8 police vehicles and 2 fire vehicles to my house when nothing had happened except I had made a non-emergency 911 call in which I was concerned about a suspicious vehicle? Now, this is non-emergency. That means that there's nothing happening that deserves police action. All I want to know is I need some explanation from a police officer about this suspicious vehicle. And when it turns out the suspicious vehicle actually belonged to the police department, then they sent this suspicious vehicle, which was the object of my concern, to my house. Now, that's, with anybody with any brains, that's clearly a provocative way to handle a 9/11 call.
Now, let's talk a bit about the courtroom issues here. Who's the judge, or who has been the judge in this case? And who is the prosecutor? I understand they've actually put in force a almost never used special prosecutor situation for something like a ridiculous misdemeanor charge, which has never been done.
Yes, the state's attorney's office, Richard Devine, has appointed. This is Cook County, Illinois. This is where Mayor Daley just won his 6th reelection, I think it is. They've appointed a special person to handle this case. It is a person from the state's attorney's office, but she's a special appointment to handle this case. Her name is Elizabeth Hantzos, and I think she's a Greek American woman, and she is handling the case. And as my lawyer told me, this is the most unheard of thing. He's a former supervisor for the state's attorney's office, and he said this is the most unheard of thing.
Now, who are the judges involved? Who have been your judges?
Well, first there was a Greek woman named Carla Halios, then there was a couple other judges. It went very quickly. I've asked for a jury trial, so I've been moved to a different hall, and the judge that has been there last time is a great big bear of a guy named Ursos, Judge Ursos, which I think means bear in Latin or Italian.
Yes, it does.
he's quite a tough judge, but I did not, my lawyer, this Jack Smeaton guy was advising me to accept the plea bargain in which I would accept, in which one, the aggravated assault case would be thrown out, and that I would accept some community service or some $200 fine, but accept guilt for resisting arrest. And I told him, Mr. Smeaton, from the beginning, these charges are baseless, and if they're not dismissed, I want to fight them. If I have to fight them in court, I want to fight them in a jury trial. And unfortunately, for the last 4 months, this happened almost 6 months ago, he squandered my time. He's wasted my money. He hadn't done anything. He didn't do anything until I gave him a letter to withdraw at the end of January. And now I'm in a situation, this is quite a predicament, where he is still my attorney, pending a new attorney taking the case and being accepted by the court. And I have found another attorney who is also a former attorney, a state's attorney, but he seems to be more willing to fight this and to do the investigation that needs to be done. I mean, for example, the 14 police officers that were at my house need to be interviewed. I don't think you can do depositions, but they need to be interviewed, and we need to find out, you know, what were the orders and what was going on.
Because how about an attack on the Fourth Estate? I mean, we're talking about, you know, you being a long-standing, well-known journalist, and we're talking about an attack on a journalist.
Yes, but the thing is that's harder to prove, you know, because I called 911. And I called 911 because of a suspicious vehicle. You know, putting together all of the pieces to indicate that this was an attack because of my journalism work would require either the admission or some information coming from the other side that was indeed what was going on. I mean, at this point, we can speculate and think that might be what was going on, but I can't prove it yet.
Yeah. Well, it seems like that the jury trial, if they do a fair selection, you know, these preemptive challenges and all this nonsense going on. I mean, you know, who knows who you'll have sitting on the jury? But if they look at these facts, if they're not shocked by it, you know, every person who hears this story should be shocked. Have you thought about actually representing yourself?
Yeah, I've thought about that. That still might happen, but that's a bit risky because, you know, I don't understand how the system, I'm not legally educated, I don't know how the system works, and I've seen how this judge, when I've seen other people representing themselves, how they were treated completely unfairly in the court. You know, they come up in the court, they try to represent themselves, and he just denies everything and throws the book at them. And you see, you're in a very precarious situation when you represent yourself and you're not educated as a lawyer. It's a precarious thing. You know, the state of Illinois can give you an advisor, but I've got the people's legal office working on this. I've talked to many, many lawyers, and I just hope that I found a good one. You know, I've been trying to raise some money because my newspaper actually collected a great deal of money for me. The American Free Press started a legal defense fund, but they kept the money, or they say that we turned some of it to the other people. But this is very strange. They collected a great deal of money for my legal defense, and then
Excuse me. Did any check get sent from American Free Press to you at all, money? Did they send any?
I think that Mike Piper sent me one check that was for like $30 and was made out in my name. But the strange thing is that I think many people made out checks in my name and that these, or to my legal defense fund. And, you know, these checks were probably deposited in American Free Press account pretty quickly. Or one of their accounts. They have many shell accounts, you know.
Well, that brings me to the next subject. You know, we've looked, and you've had a chance to read on the site the Bill Cooper piece and the DeGuayo report.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the DeGuayo report and Bill Cooper's work both point in some very stark terms. People within the white nationalist movement, which, have been against putting a color, a racial tone to this. This is not about white and black. This is about criminals and non-criminals. But there's some very suspicious charges that are being leveled by this DeGuayo report that was written actually in the mid-1970s, and then the follow-on report that was done by Bill Cooper is pretty damning. And what's your take on those?
Yeah, well, I've read them. There may be some things that are not quite correct. There might be some inaccuracies. There might be some disinformation in there. But I agree completely that the nationalist patriotic movement in the United States has been completely compromised, and has been so from the beginning. I mean, look, it's a nation of 300 million people, and we don't even have a nationalist political party. We don't have a third party. You see, we don't have a solid patriotic nationalist truth-telling paper that's looking out for the American people. I mean, for example, there's a party called the America First Party. I know that party because I used to belong to it. I was one of the founders of the Reform Party back in the days of Patrick Buchanan, when we really geared up this third party movement. I was, on the state of Illinois delegation. But I saw very clearly after Buchanan ran, we had a new election for new officers, and there was a fellow named Dan Charles, a Jewish guy from Denver, Colorado. And he ran for every office that was available until he finally won one. I think he was elected as a treasurer. And the people at this conference, I think it was in Nashville, they couldn't believe it. This guy was so desperate to get a position. Well, he is now the head of the party, which has been renamed the America First Party. Have they done anything? Have you heard of them? Of course not. Because all of these third party, these nationalist movements, these independent movements, are co-op from the beginning. You see, this is what the powers that be, the Zionists and the CIA and these intelligence outfits, this is what they have to do. They have to co-opt the political movements in the United States in particular. I mean, there's a very good example of this. In Germany, for example, an occupied country, occupied by the United States and Britain to this day. Yeah. There's a newspaper called the National Zeitung, which is printed by a Jewish millionaire. His last name is F-R-E-Y, I believe. American Free Press asked me to visit him when I was in Germany. So I went and visited him and met with his son. And it was interesting, during this conversation, they have this paper that's available, National Zeitung, National Paper. It's available in bookstores and news stalls all around Germany, particularly in the South. Yet, when I asked them, I said, I'm gonna go talk to another German nationalist leader named Manfred Reuter. I've been asked to visit him. And this young fry told me, no, you can't visit him. He's a terrorist. He's saying that this 80-year-old man named Manfred Reuter, who's been in jail in Germany for years, was a terrorist. Well, eventually I did meet Mr. Manfred Reuter, and I told him about this. I said, the guys that run this National Zeitung newspaper told me that I shouldn't interview you because you were a terrorist. And I said, do you have any idea why they would go against you? And he said, there's a paper like that, and their purpose is to skim the steam off the nationalist movement. Basically to be the only voice of the nationalist movement in Germany, for example, and to compile a list of subscribers, a list of supporters, and to skim the cream off the movement, to collect money.
Yeah.
And when I heard this, I was really interested. I got on the phone. I spoke to Willis Carter, who's the publisher of American Free Press. I told him exactly what Manfred Reuter had said. I mean, Manfred Reuter is the real thing. And Mr. Carter didn't say anything. He wasn't surprised or anything by what I told him. And then about 6 months later or so, or a year later, he's telling me I should go visit the Fries again. And I told him, Mr. Carter, don't you remember what we know about these people? But this is the same thing. It's a nationalist paper that does nothing, accomplishes nothing, does not protest the occupation. And this is the same way I feel about American Free Press. This American Free Press paper, I worked for 6 years. I did my utmost, my best, to try and advance that paper and to improve its quality. But it never grew. It never grew. I mean, it's a paper that's printed in Washington, D.C., but you can't even buy it in Washington, D.C., you see? And it only has a subscription base, I mean, paid subscribers of something like 20,000 people, if that many. Now, that's pathetic. In a nation the size of the United States, after 9/11, with two illegal wars going on, two costly, disastrous wars, when the nation's sovereignty is being challenged by these supranational agreements like NAFTA,
yeah,
that we only have 20,000. So it's really It simply is dramatic.
Well, let me ask you this, Chris. Let me ask you this question. I mean, Eric and I have discussed, and I did a show just a few days ago regarding my stand on homosexuality. I stated pretty clearly, I don't care what people's sexual choices are personally. What I had an issue with is how the powers that be oftentimes use issues such as homosexuality or things such as pedophilia or things, or they go to these kinds of places to recruit their people. And when I read the DeGioia report and I read the Bill Cooper's report, it was in keeping with the what I had discovered over the last couple of years in looking into this, that you'll find a lot of these groups have leadership that are either homosexual or this guy feels that's always on with Piper. He's been charged with pedophilia. Mm-hmm. You look at this kind of stuff and you say to yourself, is it a coincidence or is it more by design?
Right. I just heard on the news the other day that the ACLU, the guy that was writing the legislation regarding pedophilia for the ACLU, has been discovered to actually be a pedophile himself. I just caught that on the news yesterday. But this is the thing. I don't exactly understand how it works, but these people are compromised. They seem to be very politically active. When I came to American Free Press, I thought it was very odd. I was the only person in the office who was married and had children. And there were about five or six other men of my age or a little bit older, and none of them were married and none of them had children. And I thought, well, that's odd. You know, and the editor, Chris Pefferick, was an avowed Satanist. I thought that was really weird, but, you know, freedom of religion, I guess. And I thought that Satanism was some sort of like being a witch or something. I didn't understand, but he had this steel bolt through his tongue, some sort of peg through his tongue, which I couldn't believe why somebody would have something like that in their mouth, but, and then the, Mike Piper works there, and I learned very quickly that Mike Piper is a homosexual, but, you know, like you, it's no big deal. I figured he was a good writer, and he's just, goes the other way. I didn't hold it against anybody, but now I see that there's much more to this because,
this is my point exactly.
I don't know if American Free Press was behind my attack, but I can certainly tell you that immediately after my attack, they were involved in another attack on me, which they led with a person named Scott McCufka.
Who they're still working directly with now.
Yeah, this Victor Thorne. He goes by the name Victor Thorne. That's his pen name, but he uses his pen name, like, in public as well. But his real name is Scott McCufka. And he was tied up with this Lisa Giuliani girl for a few years after 9/11. But, yeah, the Chris Pefferick has edited a book with him recently on Iran, and he published and worked with books by Michael Piper. Yeah. So immediately after I was tasered, I mean, I was not even healed yet from the damage the taser causes. You know, the taser, if you get tasered, in my case, I was sick for about 2 weeks. They put the taser right over my liver and blasted me right over my liver. And it may have released something, done something to my liver, but I was very sick for about 2 weeks and could hardly get out of bed. And so, but I, you know, Mike Piper called me, wanted me to be on his radio show as a guest, and he said he was going to have this Victor Thorne on, and he pretended like he was going to really hold Victor Thorne's feet to the fire about his claims and Lisa Giuliani's claims that my police report was a fabrication. And what's interesting is that when Scott McCooper came on the air, it seems like Michael Piper had to take one of his frequent bathroom breaks, and Scott McCooper basically took over the show. And the first thing he did is he wanted to interrogate me on four questions. He raised one question. First thing he said that do I reject or do I renounce the lies of Eric Hubschmid? And I said I'm not renouncing anybody, but and you know, I asked who made this guy the chief inquisitor. I said, some Israeli interrogator to me, but Michael Piper allowed this. And then what they did is that by forcing me to answer a question about an article that I had not even seen. You know, some of your listeners might not be aware, but Eric Hubschmid are three different people living in three different places. We work together. I mean, we collaborate in some degree, but we're not you know, I'm not responsible for what Eric Cushman writes. And Eric Cushman posted this piece in which he raised questions about American free press. I mean, that's his God-given right as an American citizen, freedom of speech. And I had not read the article, and I told this Makufka and Piper, I said, I'm sorry, I haven't seen this article, and I can't comment on it. And that's what they held against me. They held that against me, that comment, what I said, and then they charged me with disloyalty. You know, in the same way that Anne Boleyn was charged with disloyalty to the king, I was charged with disloyalty, and then they started this big attack against me, and this was joined by other people like Lisa Giuliani and Signs of the Times and a bunch of other people, and no, by October 7th, I was fired from my job.
Well, you know, that same group has been attacking me from the beginning, and it all started way back when we started exposing some of the anomalies for coming out of their group. And, of course, they didn't want us doing that, and so they, rather than attack us on substance, they started calling me names and started making very bizarre accusations about me, and it ended up being very clear that these people were no good. And when we investigated, it came back that Scott Makufka was from a Jewish heritage, which is not in itself a damning condition, but rather it points to a consistent pattern, again, in some of these research groups that are so-called 9/11 research groups. Now, somebody, see, he claimed repeatedly he wasn't, but his son, Adam...
Yeah.
Makufka was bar mitzvahed.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you bar mitzvah your son, if that's that means anything to anybody else out there, but it was actually on the internet that there were invitations that went out for a bar mitzvah or something, and then there was also this thing where he married a young Jewish girl in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Now, that again doesn't cause... any kind of ripples in my pond until you look at the associations that go along with it, Christopher. You see, being Jewish would not predispose anybody to anything except being Jewish. But when you start looking at the associations that come along with that, that's when my antennas start wagging, you know?
Right. Well, you know, it's the same thing with American Free Press. American Free Press, big poncho there, is a guy named Mark Lane. He's a lawyer. He's a Jewish lawyer. His father's name was Harry Levin. And I think they're also from Cleveland, if I remember correctly. Mr. Levin, the accountant, changed his name after he married this lady. And then they had, some children, and they became Lane, Mark Lane. It was one of his sons. And there were two boys and a girl. But the thing is that this is the lawyer who has represented American Free Press for years, prior to that spotlight and the Liberty Lobby. And this organization, American Free Press, or the Spotlight, was created out of the Liberty Lobby, which was basically spawned by the John Birch Society, and Will Pardo has been running it all along. Now, but the strange thing is that in all of these lawsuits in America that the Spotlight had, against people like other right wing people or other conservative newspapers like the paper they used to work for, William F. Buckley, for example, had a lawsuit with him. Mark Lane represented them, and in these, of course, were very expensive lawsuits. And I was told by a newspaper in Cincinnati called Criminal Politics that was sued by Mark Lane in 1995 for $10 million. I was told by the publisher of that newspaper that that Mark Lane had actually taken over the assets of the Spotlight and the Liberty Lobby in 1994 when that weekly newspaper went bankrupt. And so that made, according to this publisher in Cincinnati, that made Mark Lane the owner of the Spotlight and the Liberty Lobby. And I asked Mr. Cardo if this is true. I spoke to him on the phone, called him after I was fired. I said, is this true? And he went ballistic, as he often does, and he swore and said, that's a lie, and then hung up the phone. But, I don't know. There's no transparency at American Free Press, which is something else that I fault them for. I mean, if you're a populist paper, if you claim to represent the nationalist movement, the patriotic movement in this nation, in the United States, well, then there should be some transparency. Who are people? Who owns it? Where does the money go? Etc. I never encountered any transparency of any sort in American Free Press. There's a bunch of little shell companies, and when they call American Free Press a employee-owned paper, that's a complete fraud. Because I was an employee of American Free Press when they became an employee-owned paper, and I was never given any stock. I was given a letter that said that this was going to happen, but my stock disappeared on Michael Piper's desk. But the thing is, the question is, with all of these various shell companies, you have to ask which companies are funded and which ones aren't. That is to say, where does the money go? And I can tell you that American Free Press doesn't even own the typewriters they work on. All of the stuff that American Free Press employees probably own is nothing but even the name. There's nothing there. And in all the years I've worked there, I've never seen anybody who can make any decision other than Mr. Cardo.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, if I were in Europe or calling from South America and I needed, an emergency $500, everything has to go through Mr. Cardo. Everything. You know, the editor of the paper can't decide anything. That's Chris Petrick. He doesn't decide anything. But Chris Petrick and Mike Piper have worked very closely with Scott McCuffin. Now, you have to ask yourself this question. On Mike Piper's shows, you know, when I was doing his show during the summer and then when he came back from Asia, whenever I was on his show, he'd always say, and Christopher Bolin, in my opinion, America's best in journalist, bar none. I thought this is way over the top, but he would always say that. And then I went from that to becoming, in his last radio show when he talked about me, he said, I'm somebody who should be thrown in Cook County Jail and raped.
And sodomized, yes.
How do I go from America's best journalist, bar none, somebody who should be tortured and raped in Cook County Jail? You know, this guy doesn't make any sense.
When we look at this stuff from where we sit, I've been at this for some time now, along with Eric, and what we try to do, Eric and I, is to point out the anomalies in the groups that are surrounding this supposed truth movement, because I use that word truth, sort of tongue in cheek here, because there's nothing truthful about most of the stuff coming out of these people. And we've looked at things that come out of Alex Jones, and of course this man is getting tens and tens of thousands of people to tune into his show, and yet he will get right on the radio and say that there is no evidence that Israel or its agents have anything to do with 9/11. Or anything to do with Oklahoma City. And he blames it entirely on an American conspiracy, or he says international bankers sponsored German death cult, or he says the New World Order or something. But my research finds a very different story, and anybody who looks at this for any length of time does as well. And so when you're being that blatant after 13 years in the movement about telling the truth, there is something terribly wrong there. And then you start looking at who he associates with him and who gives him the their effort. And you can find Mike Rivero, who talks about a passenger jet hitting the Pentagon, which anybody with a brain knows didn't happen. There's so many things that start showing up here. And what we figured out, Eric and I, is that they want to end up in charge when the truth starts coming out. They want to be in charge of telling the world what the truth is, and it's going to be their version of it, not the real truth.
Well, this is exactly what we were talking about before, about how the Zionists or this international criminal gang that is Zionist in nature, how these people take over political parties and movements. They do the same thing, for example, in the 9/11 truth movement. Then they do the same thing, for example, in an anti-war movement. For example, at the University of California in the first Gulf War, I started a Palestine support group, an anti-war movement, because I could see the war coming down the tubes back in July of 1990. But what happened at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where I was, is that lo and behold, when the war actually began, the anti-war movement on campus was taken over by Hillel. That is the Jewish fraternity sorority on the campus group for Jews. they took it over, and there were a couple of young guys from Hillel who took over as the heads of the anti-war movement. Why? Because exactly as with 9-1-1, it was very important that there was no linkage of Israel and the first Gulf War. You know,
that's right.
Everybody was talking about linkage and Israeli involvement in the first Gulf War. In this war, the anti-war movement is run by Zionists because they don't want to be dragged into it.
That's right.
They want to keep Israel's name out of it. The same thing with the 9/11 movement. While there's an abundance of evidence, you know, I've written a great deal about Israeli involvement. I'm trying to put those articles together into a book to compile them because I've written, you know, scores of articles about Israeli involvement in 9/11. But for people like Alex Jones to deny that there's any Israeli involvement is to deny the evidence. I mean,
that's right.
How do they explain the evidence of Odigo instant messages? How do they explain the numerous Israelis who were captured working with a moving company? How do they explain that?
Well, here's the interesting thing that we've discovered, because yes, much of the conspiracy that we've uncovered does find its origins in cities across America, and we've talked, and we're going to talk again in a minute about Rahm Emanuel's family roots and to actual assassinations of political leaders and whatnot. But these people have roots directly back to Israel.
Yep.
Now,
yep.
That doesn't necessarily mean that the headquarters of this conspiracy is in Israel, because I'll tell you, Zionism is a worldwide phenomenon, and probably much of these decisions are being made in Cleveland and New York and London and elsewhere. But the fact is that their operations, their base operations, do come out of Israel.
Yes, now that's a very good point. Zionism is, in my opinion, an international criminal network.
Yeah.
It is headed by an international criminal network. There are, of course, good Jewish people who think that Zionism is just for their little homeland in the Middle East, and although it's a racial thing and exclusivist, they think that it's okay and everything's fine. That's how they think. But when you're talking about people like Rahm Emanuel and the Sheretz, you're talking about people like Shimon Peres, even though he's in the Labor Party. But what you're saying is exactly right. The Likud, the right-wing party in Israel, is headed by a bunch of crooks. I mean, just look at what's happened in Israel in the last 6 months. The president's been indicted on rape charges. The head of the police has been indicted on bribery charges. It's corrupt from top to bottom.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is that the Likud party, the hard right party, the party of Ariel Sharon and Menachem Begin and Jabotinsky, it had its roots in the Irgun, which was a terrorist militia back in the 1930s and 40s, the Irgun. And what we see today in the Likud party and the party of Kadima, which is the current party, is that we see the sons and daughters of the Likud, of the Irgun, are running the show. People like
well, and, but they found their way into very powerful political positions in the United States.
Yes, yes. And look at Rahm Emanuel, for example, from Chicago. He's a representative. He was instrumental in getting NAFTA approved. If you remember, during the Clinton administration.
Yep.
He is the person who single-handedly got NAFTA pushed through. NAFTA is very detrimental to American interests, of course.
Yep.
And my newspaper. But now, Rahm Emanuel, according to Sherman Scholm, and according to Voltaire Net, which is Thierry Masson in France, they recently wrote an article about this. Rahm Emanuel's father, whose name was Auerbach, was one of the three men involved in the assassination of Volker Bernadotte. Volker Bernadotte was the United Nations envoy to Palestine after the partition plan of 1947, when the United Nations decided they would partition Palestine, which was sort of the way they did things back in those days. You know, partition countries and send these people there and those people there, like they did in India and Pakistan. Well, that's what they tried to do in Palestine. Of course, it never worked because the Israelis, the Jews, they wanted to take everything. And so as soon as this partition plan went into effect, in which the United Nations was giving Palestinian land to a Jewish minority, all hell broke loose. Well, Volker Bernadotte, who was the brother of the Swedish king, it's from the royal family of Sweden, it's an old French family. When he went to Palestine, he went there to advise the United Nations about the practicality of this plan. And he advised against it. And he said that, you know, Jerusalem has to remain sovereign and independent. And that, you know, there have to be modifications to this plan for the Palestinians. Well, the Irgun killed him. The Stern gang of the Irgun. People like Itzhak Shamir. Itzhak Shamir was one of the people involved in the planning, if not the execution. This man's car was stopped. Volker Bernadotte was stopped in his car up near Kalandia, Jerusalem, I think it was, near the airport. They stopped on a road. These three guys got out of their car, and they went over to his door, like Bonnie and Clyde style, and they shot Volker Bernadotte and his lieutenant, Thoreau, his French lieutenant. And this was a huge setback. But you have to understand that these Israelis, that's how they do things. For example, the head of the Israeli Air Force was a South African guy, and he flew at about the same time, he flew a plane from France to England with a hit squad to kill a senior British military commander involved in the mandate in Palestine. So they will send the hit squad to a foreign country to take out a political leader or a military leader who is opposed to their designs in the Middle East.
Well, but one needs to also look at the top and how Israel's founding and its continued support has come from the Rothschild fortune. They still pay for immigrants to go to Palestine if they are avowed Zionist immigrants. In other words, people who are staunchly in support of the Jewish criminal possession of that land in the Middle East, you will get a huge chunk of change directly from the Rothschild fortune. And you'll also notice that the administration buildings throughout Israel that are being built, such as their new court building that is supposed to have some international things going on with it, an international courts building built in outside of Jerusalem, was entirely built by Rothschild. And so what I'm saying is that if you go back in time as well, you'll see connections to Rothschild as well.
Of course. You know, the infamous Balfour Declaration, I think it was 1914 or 1913, the Balfour Declaration that promised the Jews a homeland in Palestine.
Was a still,
It was signed by Lord Balfour, I think it was the Prime Minister at the time. This is where the Israeli state was born. It was a letter, the Balfour Declaration was actually a letter written to Mr. Rothschild in London. And it has traditionally been that the Rothschild in London was the secular head of world Jewry. So he was writing this. The Balfour Declaration was a letter written to the head of secular Jewry that the British state looked with favor upon the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. So,
well, you know, and what we've done, Christopher, Eric, and I, I spent 3 hours twice now, so 6 hours of my life watching the most powerful video I think I've ever seen, even more powerful than any of the 9/11 ones, because it talks about the history of criminal banking in the world. It's called The Money Masters, and if you want to know if we're still in the midst of a Rothschild international banking criminal conspiracy, you just have to look at history. And history will spell it out for you for 400 years how this has been going on from day one, and nothing has changed. And now, of course, they'll try to get you to think it's about religion or it's about all kinds of stuff. Oil, it's not about religion or oil. It's about an agenda that is going to consolidate power in a small group of people's hands that are from one particular group. And that particular group is a radicalized form of Judaism. It is certainly not all Jews, but this radicalized form of Judaism is in control of our press and our money systems and our natural resources and our largest corporations. And when you take a look at this, you start understanding that we are in a pile of dung up to our eyeballs here.
Yes, there's no question about it. And I have always said that the biggest problem and the biggest betrayal of the American people is the idea that we have a free media, that we have a free press in the United States. It's you know, when I look at American television and look at American newspapers, it feels like the most propagandized country in the world.
Yeah. It is.
And this is very, you know, you look at 9/11 as a prime example. You know, I wrote a great deal about this, and in that, even though there were many, many eyewitnesses on 9/11 who reported seeing and hearing explosions, this subject was completely pushed under the rug immediately.
Yeah.
And you have to ask yourself, how did we know to push this under the rug? And I saw there's recently a little clip online from yesterday or so that the BBC was reporting that the World Trade Center 7 had collapsed before it even collapsed.
That's right.
I don't know if this is a spoof or anything, you know.
No, but, it's not a spoof, and in fact, but one might wonder how come someone like Alex Jones is the person being permitted to out this information.
Yeah, I know, and why it took 5 years for this to come out, because, you know, most of the important things came out, have come out already. You know, like, I agree with Eric and you that we've already pretty much, you know, exposed what happened on 9/11, but the media is still not interested in the evidence. For example, CNN came to interview me, just like Fox News when they interviewed me back in 2003, they're not interested in the evidence. I had printed out $12 worth of pages of photographs and evidence, but the CNN girls weren't interested in that at all. They just wanted me to say something about...
I'm losing you, Christopher. Where are you going? We've lost Christopher for a moment here on his phone. Chris? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've lost Christopher's connection. We're going to have to get him back. Carol Brett.